This episode of Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. In the last episode, we covered the claim of Billy Sol Estes that Mack Wallace was Lyndon Johnson's hitman and that Wallace killed USDA Inspector Henry Marshall and President Kennedy. The evidence for Wallace killing Marshall was a mixed bag. On one hand, Estes said he was there with Marshall when Lyndon Johnson ordered the murder, and he was at the follow-up meeting with Mack Wallace after it happened. On top of that, a local gas station attendant says a man came in asking where the Marshall farm was on the day of the murder. The description the gas station attendant gave of that man was similar to Mack Wallace. On the other hand, Wallace has an alibi from his brother and son who claimed that he was with them in California at the time of the Marshall murder. In this episode, we analyzed the two strongest arguments that Mack Wallace was involved in the murder of President Kennedy at the behest of Vice President Johnson. We'll look at the fingerprint found on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository that allegedly belongs to Mack Wallace, and the recently released Billy Sol Estes tape that appears to incriminate Mack Wallace and Lyndon Johnson.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody. The man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? The mission answers, he acted alone.
I'm working.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. On the day of President Kennedy's assassination, the FBI collected fingerprints from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository building. One of the many prints that was collected was labeled Indistinct Characteristics. This print is labeled Print 29 in Warren Commission Exhibit 656. The print was lifted from a carton sitting at the edge of the entrance to the sixth floor. According to the National Archives, the print belonged to, quote, an unknown person. The fact that this fingerprint was found on a cardboard box meant that it had to have been created within 10 days of the assassination, because after that period of time, fingerprints disappear from cardboard. The first person to take interest in this unknown print was retired Dallas police officer John Harrison. Harrison had been studying Mack Wallace in depth, and he wanted to check this unknown print against Wallace's fingerprints. In 1996, Harrison was able to get Wallace's official fingerprints from his arrest on October 22, 1951, the day that Wallace killed John Kinzer at the Pitch and Putt in Austin. Once Harrison had the Wallace fingerprint, he brought it to a certified latent print examiner named Nathan Darby, who had worked for the Austin Police Department. Harrison asked Darby to compare the 1951 Wallace print with the unknown print from the sixth floor of the school book depository building. Significantly, Harris did not tell Darby anything about the fingerprints. After Darby reviewed the prints, he signed a sworn affidavit that declared that he discovered 14 matching points in the fingerprints. This affidavit also concluded that the two fingerprints belonged to the left pinky finger of the same person. Darby continued reviewing the prints and claimed that he found a total of 34 matching points. After Darby's determination had been provided, only then was he told that the prints were related to the JFK assassination and that one of them belonged to Mack Wallace. Given the high-stakes nature of this particular fingerprint identification, John Harrison wanted a second opinion. So Harrison hired E. Harold Hoffmeister, a print examiner who worked for the Texas Department of Public Safety, to compare the same fingerprints that Nathan Darby reviewed. Hoffmeister then signed an affidavit on April 15, 1998, that said, quote, "It is my opinion that an unknown latent print I compared with the inked fingerprint impression of a subject unknown to me at this time matches the left little fingerprint of this subject." However, after Hoffmeister found out that the prints were related to the Kennedy assassination, he recanted his affidavit. Hoffmeister said, quote, "After Mr. Harrison left, I continued to analyze the two prints, and the longer I looked at them, the more questioned I became. Some points matched, and they didn't. Then all points matched. Then no points matched. I then realized that both the other fingerprint examiner and I were having to make mental decisions due to the fact that we were dealing with unknown generations of copies of the latent and not the original." Harrison dismissed Hoffmeister's changed opinion because he thought Hoffmeister changed his mind out of fear as opposed to a reasoned decision. Harrison then sent Nathan Darby's findings to the FBI. 18 months later, the FBI responded with a telephone call to say that the print match was incorrect. The FBI did not provide any rationale or supporting documentation to Harrison for this finding. In 2003, according to Nathan Darby's friend, attorney Don Meredith, Darby's home was burglarized. The security alarm was bypassed, and the only item missing was a file relating to Mack Wallace's fingerprint that Darby kept under his bed. So we have the original Nathan Darby print match, which Darby always stood behind. Then we have Hoffmeister confirming what Darby said, only to change his conclusion after he found out that the prints were related to the JFK assassination. In 2013, eager to get real clarity on the issue of whether the unknown sixth floor school book depository print really belonged to Mack Wallace, author Joan Mellon contacted Robert Garrett, a certified latent print examiner who once supervised crime scenes in Middlesex County, New Jersey. More importantly, at the time he rendered his opinion for Mellon, Garrett was in charge of fingerprint examiner certification programs for the International Association of Identification, the accrediting institution for fingerprint experts throughout the world. In other words, there is not a higher ranked expert than Garrett. He's the guy who certifies experts. Without telling him who these prints allegedly belong to, Mellon provided Garrett with the same documents that Darby and Hoffmeister reviewed: the 1951 Austin police print and print 29 from Warren Report Commission Exhibit 656. When he opened up the file, Garrett immediately said that he couldn't work with a photocopy of the Warren Commission exhibit as Darby and Hoffmeister had done. He needed a negative or a first-generation photograph of the latent print to be able to make an accurate determination. Mellon then obtained a clear first-generation photo of print 29 from the National Archives. But Garrett said that there was also a problem with Wallace's Austin police prints. The prints had a smudge because the roller had not been thoroughly cleaned off after its use with the previous person. Mellon assisted Garrett by acquiring a very clear copy of Mac Wallace's fingerprints from when he was enlisted in the Marines in 1939 from the Navy. Garrett then confirmed that the 1939 Marine prints did match Wallace's 1951 smudged Austin police prints. Nathan Darby and Harold Hoffmeister both relied on the old school black and white method of fingerprint identification. But in 2013, when Joan Mellon was working with Bob Garrett, new technology was available that captured the grayscale and provided more detailed information. Using digital fingerprint identification technology, Garrett then compared the 1939 Marine prints with the high-resolution photo of print 29. The result, according to Garrett, is that the two fingerprints do not match. For good measure, Garrett compared the sixth floor print to all of Wallace's fingers, not just his left pinky finger. There was still no match. In other words, according to modern technology and a top expert, Mac Wallace's fingerprint was not found on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository Building. This determination from Robert Garrett, who is without a doubt a qualified expert on the matter, was not without controversy in the JFK assassination community. Critics of Joan Mellon's work, led by Professor David Denton, argue that we should not throw out the Mac Wallace fingerprint just yet. The first counterpoint is that Mellon says she received the new prints from the FBI, and given that the FBI has not always been forthcoming in the case, we cannot trust these prints. However, in Mellon's book, she states that she obtained the prints from either the National Archives or the Navy. She does not claim to have gotten them from the FBI. The next counterpoint is that Garrett's examination of the prints was not a true double-blind examination. This is because Joan Mellon was a well-known author on JFK assassination topics at the time, and Garrett could have easily Googled her to determine what the examination was likely to be about. Also, Garrett's written report specifically mentions the Wallace print and the Warren Commission exhibit by name. It is possible that Garrett only learned that after the examination, but before writing the report. The third counterpoint made by JFK researcher Richard Bartholomew is that Mellon failed to give Garrett high-resolution copies of the prints that were actually used by Darby and Hoffmeister. Now, I couldn't find any independent support for this claim, but it is troubling, if true. Zooming out to the big picture, we are trying to determine whether Mac Wallace was on the sixth floor as evidenced by a fingerprint that is supposedly linked to Wallace. And remember, this fingerprint is not the only evidence for Wallace being on the sixth floor. There's also the Warren Commission testimony of Richard Randolph Carr, who says that from his vantage point across the street on the ninth floor of the courthouse stairwell, he saw a man on the sixth floor of the school book depository who was a, quote, heavyset individual who was wearing a hat, tan sport coat, and horn-rimmed glasses. When Carr came down the stairs and went outside, after the shots were fired, he saw that same man get into a Nash Rambler that was parked on Record Street. Carr never recanted this testimony, even though he was pressured to change it by the FBI. He also had three attempts on his life in the years after the assassination. Additionally, you may recall that witness Carolyn Walther also saw a man in a brown sport coat standing behind the shooter. And James Worrell, who was standing very close to the building, saw a man in a dark sport coat running out of the back of the building shortly after the shooting. Neither Carr, Walther, nor Worrell ever had the chance to identify Wallace at a lineup. But Wallace's body type and the glasses that he often wore are consistent with Carr's identification. Then again, that identification could match a lot of other people too. At the time of the assassination, Mack Wallace lived in Anaheim, California, working for Ling Electronics. Wallace's son Michael, who was then 15 years old, says that Wallace was home for dinner on the night President Kennedy died. Michael recalled feeling distressed that the president had been killed in Texas. He told Joan Mellon that his dad tried to console him about it. He did not recall the exact time his dad returned home that night, but Michael Wallace was sure that Mack Wallace was in Anaheim, California on November 22, 1963. After looking at all of that information, the weight of the evidence seems to be that the fingerprints do not match. Although the Nathan Darby burglary, where the burglars only took the Mack Wallace fingerprint, does sound very shady if true. We also have an alibi for Wallace from his son that he was in Anaheim at work on the day of the assassination. Of course, it is possible that Wallace's son was making a self-serving statement to defend his father. There are no known facts to support that. Still, there is another piece of recently unearthed evidence that strongly implicates Mack Wallace in the murders of Henry Marshall and President Kennedy. An incriminating audio tape recording of a conversation between Billy Sol Estes and Cliff Carter, the right-hand man of Lyndon Johnson. Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. They found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern you can think of. Best of all, not only is every product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you can get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches the mood you're looking for. 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. I don't know about you, but when I need to get into that Curtis LeMay, sitting there watching the autopsy vibe, I look for a cigar that I can rely on. And that's why I love Thompson Cigar. They've been around since 1915, so they know a thing or two about cigars. Whether it's a quick five-pack for the weekend or joining one of their value clubs, Thompson makes it easy to save while enjoying top-notch cigars. It's like having your own personal humidor with deals that you can't pass up. Visit www.thompsoncigar.com/JFK or use code JFK at checkout for 20% off of your order of $75 or more. Discover why Thompson has been America's humidor since 1915 and join the thousands of satisfied customers who trust Thompson for quality, value, and exceptional service. On January 23, 2025, the grandson of Billy Sol Estes, Shane Stevens, went on The Alex Jones Show and shared a shocking tape with the world. The tape is a recorded in-person conversation between Estes and Cliff Carter. Here's what Stevens had to say about it.
My granddad died in 2013, and it was a couple few years after he passed away, so I'm going to guess maybe 2015, 16, somewhere in that time frame. And my Uncle Daryl, he was getting dementia, and he's like, I've got these tapes. And he said that he didn't want to discard them, that he was supposed to know the right time to release them. That time never came. So he passed them on. They ended up coming to me for safekeeping. So this tape was, to the best of my understanding, recorded perhaps 1971 or two, somewhere in that time frame, just based on what they're talking about, really based on Cliff Carter's timeline of when he passed away. And it's as plain as day, these two talking very openly about who was involved and the assassination of JFK.
Without further delay, here's the tape recording that Shane Stevens, Billy Sol Estes' grandson, brought to light earlier this year.
Richard, good to see you. How's life treating you today?
Well, Sol, it's been a pretty touch-and-go situation. Linda and I have had quite a few unpleasant words here lately over the deal with that he hired Mike Wallace to assassinate the president. Issued that order to Mike. But we've had our differences, and I'm a true blue to Lyndon, as I've always been, and tried to carry out every order that he'd ever given me. But this is one I'll probably never be able to forget. And the times that we've had in Texas, and the embarrassment that Lyndon Kennedy. I guess there wasn't anything else to do but what he did.
Well, you know, Lyndon could have really hit me if he would.
Well, Lyndon's the kind of person that doesn't want to help anyone. He's, you know, he's all for Lyndon, and that's the way he's pretty much always been.
Well, they had me backed up on that Henry Marshall killing, and they just kind of blackmailed me to keep my mouth shut. If I hadn't had a bunch of tapes that I played after it got killed, as you know, 17 got killed in this situation very mysteriously. And I've done a lot of time, and I've lost a lot of money, and hurt my family a whole lot. And it's really got me disgusted with Lyndon in one way. In one way, I feel real sorry for him. Feel like that in Lyndon's heart, he felt like that he was doing the right thing. He felt like that he was the savior of the common man. I feel like that in his heart he wanted to help people that had not. But I don't believe that anything, my church background would have never let me sanction all the killings that he has done. Think about it, Cliff, do you really believe that it could have been handled anyway without killing all these people and got rid of the Kennedys? You think he would have won the election against him?
Well, I don't really believe so. You know, he tried desperately to do just that, and there didn't seem to be any other way. I know that he regrets a lot of things that he has done, but still,
friends through this.
Oh, you didn't embarrass me
in what I was today that Mike Wallace killed Henry Marshall. And I was afraid it's going to tie him into the thing, and we couldn't afford to. In fact, Pam started to write a book, and when she really got scared when she got into the thing, it was just too scary a deal. But anyhow, this too will pass.
We just heard most of the taped conversation between Billy Sol Estes and Cliff Carter that was released this year by Estes' grandson, Shane Stevens. There are a few headlines here. First and foremost, the tape says that Lyndon Johnson hired Mack Wallace to assassinate President Kennedy. But the tape also states that Billy Sol Estes was at the Bryan, Texas airport near Henry Marshall's ranch on the day that Estes says Mack Wallace killed Henry Marshall. If these statements by Estes and Carter are true, then we know that Wallace did kill Henry Marshall, and he also had some role in killing President Kennedy. There are two relevant levels of analysis here. First, we have to look at the authenticity of the tape itself. Then, we must look at the facts and circumstances surrounding the recording. Stevens debuted this important audio recording on InfoWars, but he has since been on several other podcasts and talk shows to discuss it. When Stevens was interviewed by Glenn Beck, he brought the physical audio tapes with him. Here's a clip of Beck and Stevens discussing the actual tapes.
I have to tell you, we wanted to see the actual tape to verify that you had tapes from that time, etc. And you pulled them out, and they're in a little baggie. Do you happen to have that?
I do.
Pull them out in a little baggie. You terrify me with this.
They're very old.
Yeah. So he comes to the studio, and you've only been presenting the digital form.
Right.
And you came to the studio with this little please take them out of the little baggie and let us help you preserve them, because this is game-changing. And I want to play it directly from the cassette so everybody knows what you heard before is it. You want to play?
I will.
Stevens then goes on to play the same recording you just heard earlier directly from a mini tape recorder machine. So it appears that there really was a tape. The mini cassette format was invented in 1967. Thus, we know that the technology did exist at the time of this conversation. However, given how high the stakes are in this case, it would be helpful to submit the tape that Stevens has to an independent expert who can assess the approximate date of the tape based on the precise model of the cassette tape that was used. Since Billy Sol Estes was released from prison on July 12, 1971, and Cliff Carter died on September 21, 1971, we know that this tape, assuming it is real, must have been recorded in that window of time. Stevens says the tape was given to his uncle and then passed down to him. The chain of custody appears to be legitimate here. In my view, the tape itself does seem to be authentic until proven otherwise. I listened to two recorded phone calls between Lyndon Johnson and Cliff Carter to see if I could compare the Carter voice on the tape with Carter's proven voice. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to rule it out or confirm that it was the same person. But perhaps others who are better versed in comparative audio analysis could. Aside from the tape coming from the grandson of Billy Sol Estes, there's another reason to believe that it's credible. The existence of this tape has been documented previously on multiple occasions. You may recall that Doug Caddy was Billy Sol's lawyer when he tried to get immunity from Ronald Reagan. In Caddy's 1984 letter, the same one that lists out all the people LBJ allegedly hired Mack Wallace to kill, it says, quote, "A short time after Mr. Estes was released from prison in 1971, he met with Cliff Carter and they reminisced about what had occurred in the past, including the murders. During their conversation, Carter orally compiled a list of 17 murders which had been committed, some of which Mr. Estes was unfamiliar. A living witness was present at this meeting and should be willing to testify about it. He is Kyle Brown. In the tape that we have, Estes is the one who mentions 17 people being killed, not Carter. And on the tape, Estes is not going through who the 17 names are. Other than that, the content of the tape is very similar to what was said to exist in 1984. In Larry Hancock's 2006 book, Someone Would Have Talked, Hancock noted that Estes claimed to hold a tape recording of Cliff Carter's statements made in 1971, shortly before the deaths of both Cliff Carter and Malcolm Wallace. Kyle Brown was mentioned in Caddy's letter as a witness to the Carter-Estes meeting when the tape was made. During the 1950s, Brown used to carry large amounts of cash from Estes to Cliff Carter, which was ultimately destined for Lyndon Johnson. Estes invited both Kyle Brown and Cliff Carter to the 1971 meeting. Brown told author Harrison Livingstone that he heard Carter say that he regretted assisting Johnson in the murders. Brown described Carter as, quote, "remorseful, very sad, and very much down." Kyle Brown also told Lyle Sardee about the tapes, saying, quote, "they prove that Johnson was a cold-blooded killer." Additionally, another person, Tom Bowden, heard the tape and verified that it contained what Billy Sol Estes claimed it did. All of these claims about the tape's existence were many years before the tape was released. So we have Estes telling Doug Caddy about the tape in 1984, and we also have confirmation of the tape's existence and content from Kyle Brown and Tom Bowden. For those reasons, I find it likely that this is the same authentic tape that had been in JFK assassination research lore for decades. In this episode, we've determined rather conclusively that the fingerprint taken from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository building does not match Mack Wallace's fingerprint. I am confident in this determination because modern fingerprint scanning technology using much higher quality versions of prints demonstrated that the prints don't match, and the work was done by the highest quality expert one can find. Until someone else adds to the research by credibly challenging the findings of Robert Garrett, we can say with certainty that Mack Wallace's fingerprint was not found on the sixth floor. Of course, the problem with that is that the Billy Sol Estes Cliff Carter tape, which does appear to be authentic, clearly implicates Mack Wallace in killing both Henry Marshall and President Kennedy. I see two possibilities here. One, Mack Wallace was involved somehow in the assassinations of Henry Marshall and President Kennedy, despite not leaving his fingerprint on the sixth floor. Or, two, Billy Sol Estes and Cliff Carter, working together, fabricated a story about Mack Wallace on the tape to try to make Lyndon Johnson look bad. Let's quickly unpack those scenarios. Clearly, there had to be at least two shooters in the Kennedy assassination, likely more. To the extent Mack Wallace was involved, He could have perhaps coordinated his own actions, but the likelihood that he oversaw the plot is very low. So the question is, why would Mack Wallace be involved in a plot when he could easily be tied back to Johnson if he was caught? Remember, assuming Johnson was responsible for the Sam Smithwick murder, Johnson had other assets to use for assassinations that were not so easily tied back to him. You may recall that Smithwick was the guy who was killed in prison after contacting Coke Stevenson with information on the fraudulent 1948 election. On the other hand, we do have the guy in the brown coat and horn-rimmed glasses on the sixth floor seen by three witnesses in Dealey Plaza. Maybe Wallace was on the sixth floor, but just didn't leave a fingerprint. The challenge with that argument is that Billy Sol Estes has maintained that Wallace recruited Oswald into the plot through Jack Ruby, and that Wallace himself fired a shot from the grassy knoll at President Kennedy. There is no evidence that Mack Wallace knew Jack Ruby or Lee Harvey Oswald. The other scenario is that Estes and Carter are putting on a performance in this 1971 recording and are both saying things that they know are not true. It's understandable why Estes might do that, given that he spent time in prison and Johnson didn't help him, despite all of the kickbacks that Estes paid. I can't think of a reason why Cliff Carter would intentionally record such a monumental lie. Carter was always very close to Johnson and even rose to the role of director of the Democratic National Committee in the mid-1960s. Listening to their conversation, it doesn't seem like an act to me. It has an authentic feel. In 1964, just after the assassination, Mack Wallace's credit report shows that he had three unpaid accounts. Wallace's son, Michael, told Joan Mellon that Mack was always short on cash. When Wallace was divorced in December of 1969, he had almost no assets to his name. And when Wallace died in a single car accident in 1971, just a few months after Cliff Carter's death, incidentally, his entire estate was a $10,000 life insurance policy for each of his children. If Mack Wallace was LBJ's go-to hitman, that fact wasn't reflected in Wallace's finances. My current assessment on Mack Wallace is that he did know Lyndon Johnson, and he worked for him. Wallace may have killed Henry Marshall, but that is still an open question for me. As for Wallace's role in the assassination of President Kennedy, I find the story of Mack Wallace behind the grassy knoll fence to be improbable. Still, given the new Estes tape, there's a chance that Wallace did have some level of involvement in Dealey Plaza that day. Either way, Billy Sol Estes likely knew who killed Henry Marshall because that murder was committed to save Estes's cotton business. So I also leave the door open that Estes intentionally planted disinformation about Wallace to obscure the identity of whoever actually killed Henry Marshall. In summary, I find the question of whether Mack Wallace was involved in the assassination of President Kennedy to be inconclusive, leaning towards unlikely. Next time on Solving JFK, we turn our attention to the relationship between Lyndon Johnson, Texas oil barons, and the assassination of President Kennedy. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit SolvingJFKPodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Visit SolvingJFKPodcast.com for more information.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.